Well, as is obvious for anyone who looks at me, I'm neither a member of the class, I neither belong to a member of the class of women, nor to the future. I live in the present, and I'm a man. Well, because of that, I must admit that I'll speak with a certain degree of caution as to how that class will evolve into the future. First of all, I'd say it amazes me the amount of interest or the extent of interest which people have in forecast of the future. When I was at the Institute for the Future, we were constantly barraged with all kinds of telephone calls, letters, and just requests for tons of unavailable information about what's going to happen in the future. Well, it's not surprising from an anthropological point of view that this interest generally begins to rise as we come to the close of a decade or the close of a century, as we are now doing. The next century is only 30 years away. But there's another reason why people today particularly are interested in the future, and I think it's because they have a belief that by knowing something about what will happen tomorrow, what could happen, that they could change it. That is, they could do or take actions which would essentially change the course of what is forecasted. Well, it's kind of a funny notion, because if you really believe that you've got a fix on what's going to happen tomorrow, then you also believe that you can't change it because it will happen. Well, we really don't believe that. In fact, I know of no person or mechanism by which one can actually predict the future. You cannot determine what will happen tomorrow. What you can do instead, and what is done instead, is to try to simulate what's going on today, what's going on in the past, and generate an expectation about where things could go tomorrow. Now, that's a forecast. It's not a prediction. There's no way of knowing that that is, in fact, what will happen. So those are cautions, and I caution you because I'm not going to tell you or predictions about the future. What I'm going to do is tell you my thoughts, my ideas about what I think is very likely to evolve in the future. There are three things which go into making a forecast, which I should be mentioned. One is some information about the state of the world in which we live today and some information about the state of the world in the past. That's data. In addition, you have to have certain assumptions about how that state of the world came about, that is, what causes what in the world. And the third ingredient that goes into a forecast is a forecaster, somebody who actually takes this information, massages it, manipulates it, envisions it, and turns it into some forecast. And I mention the forecaster because it's very important, because it's the forecaster's values intrude very much into what is forecasted. And my values intrude into what my values, beliefs, and everything else intrude into what I forecast. I'd also like to say at the outset that I'm going to restrict my comments and thoughts to mainly middle-class America, white middle-class America, and white middle-class women in particular. And the reason for that is only to maintain some control over what I'm going to say. There's so many directions one could go in that I neither had the time nor the facility to go into that. And it also seems to me that the main ingredient of the current women's movement is essentially one of a white middle class phenomenon. And I'll get into that more in a minute. Well, first thing, change doesn't occur by a mere desire to affect it. Attitudes are more likely to be the result of basic institutional, technological, and economic changes than the progenitors. That is, attitudes are summarial evaluations about a given state of reality, which generally express a congenial relationship between a person and that reality. Rarely do attitudes define reality or create them. Thus, the first place to look for expectations about the changing status of women is not in the current desires to change that status, but instead in the underlying social reality which has produced those very current desires. And that's what I'd like to discuss first, is a small capsuled history of the nature and roles of women in the past and how various technological advances and sociological advances have affected what has come about today. First of all, the major change that occurred in the past is a general decline in the amount of time due to either technological advances or whatever, the amount of time that is necessary to care for houses today. And traditionally, women's role is caring for houses. So you have then people whose role it has been defined as the caring for houses with more time on their hands than they had previously. Moreover, the manner of caring for houses, that is, the technology that goes into the caring of houses, is such that it reduces it to a task which does not necessarily remove the drudgery of the task, but instead makes it one almost patently aware of the repetitiveness of the task and the lack of variety in the task. That is, enough of the task is reduced to make one to make it a repetitive and very simple to execute task, and therefore make one very aware of how boring a task it is. Okay, well, that's one thing that I think has happened. At the same time, throughout this period, there's been a tremendous increase in the education level of people in general and women also. Well, education has its benefits, but it also has its disadvantages. It gives people new ideas, ideas that they didn't have before, ideas that they weren't exposed to before. And the question is, are those ideas compatible with the reality with which they have to deal? Because simultaneously, there had been very little increase in options for working outside the home for women. So you have essentially a situation in which there's increased time from work inside the home, increased desire to work outside the home, not too much increase in options to work outside the home, and attitudes that are no longer congenial with merely working inside the home. At the same time, something else happened in our history, namely the baby boom of the Second World War. It has dominated our culture since that war and will probably continue to dominate our culture. In the 50s, it dominated the culture by the fact that the 50s can be characterized as a time when we were child-centered. That is, we were very much taken up with children and the caring for children. And if you look at popular magazines at that time, you'll see the extent to which we were concerned with the caring and feeding of children, almost to the point of adoration. Well, it's not surprising because children were a very dominant number in the culture at that time. They were the result of the baby boom that followed the Second World War. Well, it's also not surprising that in the 60s, the same group of people became young adults. That is, they became teenagers and people in their late teens and early 20s. They became what we call youth. And it's not surprising the 60s were characterized by what has come to be called the youth culture. Well, that had tremendous disadvantages for women at that time. And the reason is because the amount of time that's available by release from the drudgeries or cares and feeding of a home has to be used somewhere. And where is it to be used? Well, if it's not to be used by increased options of working outside the home, then it's going to be used in some other way. And the way it was used in the 50s, I think, was in an increased glorification of the person, a sort of the peacock function of life, the personal care. That is, there was great concern with having the car, with having the finest mink, with having the nicest and newest dress, and so on. That is, a lot of time was spent in engaging, essentially, in glorification of oneself. Well, when the 60s came and the culture became dominated by youngsters, by youth, and their habits of dress, their habits of thought, there were a number of crises that occurred at the same time, no longer allowed this peacock function to express itself. So you had another squeeze on time, and you now have women who have increased time on their hand, increasingly educated, and being beset by a world which spouts such things as one must get individually involved in the current crises and questions of the day, and yet no expansion of the opportunities to do so. Well, what does that do when you're put into these kinds of situations? Well, I think the kind of situation it puts one into is very well characterized in a recent movie, The Diary of a Mad Housewife. If you've had the advantage or joy of seeing that movie, it's an unbelievable depiction of the crisis that faces a young woman in today's world, the crisis of being beset by obligations that are menial, by not getting any sense of worth from execution of those obligations. And then in addition to having a yard full of kids and all this, she has often a husband who comes home from work and says, "But my dear, I would never run my business the way you run your house." Just some constant frustration, constant lack of personal evaluation, a feeling of a sense of worth, and sometimes just actually negative evaluation. Well, that puts women then in a position, for a very ripe position, of essentially gestating a mild revolution, which I think the so-called women's movement is a result of those forces. That is, it is itself an expression of some very basic changes that have occurred. And as a consequence of the movement itself, it now opens up and gives vent and wording and expression to all kinds of new options that women are supposed to have in the future. It gives them essentially new expectations about new things to do with their time, which has been reduced by various forces or changes in the technology and caring of households. Gives them new questions about what should be the role of a woman relative to the role of the man, and whether or not we should even have roles in the first place which are related on the basis of sex. Essentially, it opens up a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and I think that's the time we're now living in, a tremendous amount of uncertainty, frustration, and not knowing what it is one should be doing. Well, as it has turned out, this movement has become a rather sizable majority, and some estimates have put it at somewhere between 10 to 15% of the generation of women are in some sense or in some way linked to the women's liberation movement today. But that's a sizable minority. It's as sizable as the minority of blacks in this country, which is a very sizable majority and minority, and one which cannot be ignored nor trumped upon as it has in the past. Well, there's another question that faces us as we move into the future about the same age cohort, which has dominated the culture for the last two decades, because they are now at another age and another cycle of life. Namely, they're coming into their early 20s and mid-20s, which is generally and traditionally the age of child-rearing and childbearing. And I suspect if things happen in the next decade, as they have happened the last two or three, that this theme will now dominate the culture, and this age cohort will once again define what the basic culture is. It's no longer going to be a youth culture, it's going to be a young adult, 25, 26-year-old adult culture. There's already been some analysis by sociologists in France. A young woman sociologist in France has looked at this age cohort in her own country and finds that it's very likely that there's going to be a return to styles of personal care and personal dress because of the age group that's now going to dominate their society. I mention that only to keep that in mind, because in the childbearing stage is when people have most influence on what happens to the people who grow up in a society. Well, anyways, it's foreordained that there's going to be a change in the status of women, in the role of women, and in the role of men. The only question which we now face is what exactly will that change be? And we're in a state of uncertainty where we're searching around for many definitions of that role, of our roles, of the role of women, the role of men, the role of marriage, and so on down the line. Many of the current experiments that are being done in marriage, for instance, I think reflect a desire to try out new modes of relationships, new modes of behavior. One interesting thing about these experiments is that they, for the most part, involve groups of adults as opposed to two adults and some children. The sort of communal living that has been talked about and has increased in the last few years is, in a sense, an expression of a desire to develop a much larger group of people to come together and provide contact, intimacy, security for one another. It may likely be that that will have an important effect on tomorrow, and I'll get into that in a bit. Well, when I was looking over the forecast, and one thing that the Institute for the Future has is a file of forecasts, the size of which you would not believe. They have numerous library-type services where you scan almost anything you can find, get your hands on, and see what people are saying will happen, and get them from technical journals and so on. Well, anyways, I scanned this list and tried to pull out those that I thought were relevant to the nature and role and status of women. But in order to organize them, last Sunday I went to the local meeting of NOW and asked a number of the people who were there if they could answer a couple questions for me about what they perceive or would perceive as indicators of significant changes in the status of women in the future. What I wanted to do was get a hint at what is it that would be perceived today as a significant change in the status of women. So I asked them and were returned very nicely with a huge list of possibilities, which I couldn't deal with as a huge list. So what I did was to reduce it to a few central themes that I thought were prevalent in their statements. In the order of the frequency mentioned, frequency of mentioning them, the three things that stood out were, one, better jobs and equal pay. And by better jobs, it was very clearly emphasized in almost all of the statements that these jobs were not low-level jobs. They were what one would call high-power jobs, positions of executive positions, high political positions, and professional positions, as opposed to labor positions, trade positions, and so on. The second most frequently mentioned theme was that there be an interchange of home and childcare roles with men. That is, essentially, that there be some shifting of responsibilities and obligations and role assignments of men and women with regard to the caring and feeding of a home and children. The third thing mentioned was that there be an elimination of sex-related stereotypes which demean women's competence, individuality, and creative potential. And the focus here tended to be on the mass media, that is, the snickering that goes on in jokes presented in the media, the images that are presented of the dumb blonde doing one thing or another with one vagina cream or another on television, and so on. The three themes, of course, are very related. If expanded opportunities for jobs did exist, the likelihood of accepting them is limited by the present accepted responsibility for child and home care by women. Stereotypes are an attitudinal support system for limiting the opportunities for jobs to women. That is, the society justifies not giving a woman a job by saying that she has certain characteristics which prevent her from adequately executing that task. Thus, in sum, the dominant theme is an economic one. There is a desire that the status of women change in a fashion of expanded and equalized opportunities for jobs. From the suggested significant indicators of improvement, I think it's fair to say that this desire is mainly an economic one. And moreover, it's not merely for more jobs or better jobs or equal pay. It's for a very particular type of job, power jobs, high political power, and so on. And that is essentially because of that reason that I'm restricting myself to white middle-class women, because I think that's a reflection of the fact that those are the persons I talked with and a reflection of the fact that those are the themes that seem to dominate most of the organized women's group. And it's also those are the ones that have been most discussed about in terms of forecasts. So it's not to get more clerical jobs or more factory jobs, but more executive jobs. Another question I asked the people who attended the meeting was what time frame they had. Essentially, at what time, if such a change did not occur, would they take it as an indication that there were no significant change in the status of women? This tells you somewhat what the time frame is on these expectations or desires. And as it turns out, the time frame was generally from 1980 to 1990. That is, it's 10 to 20 years out, which is a relatively short time frame, but not all that short. Well, what does the future hold for potentially satisfying these demands? I've said earlier that there are three things which go into making a forecast, namely information about what's happening today and what happened in the past, assumptions about how the present evolves, and a forecaster. So let's look at some of the assumptions about the underlying nature of the factors involved in change in these three basic indicators of improvement in the status of women. When I was at the Institute for the Future, I developed a general methodology for evaluating or assessing the likelihood of any given event coming about. And the general methodology suggests that an event or a change is likely to occur to the extent it is perceived as beneficial, that is, that's operationalized by noting whether or not there are groups who would advocate or oppose that change. Presumably, the more people who advocate such a change, the more likely it is to occur. The more people who oppose such a change, the more likely it is to occur. And if there's groups which both oppose and advocate, it's likely to result in some political contest between those groups. The second thing that seems to be important for whether change comes about is whether it's costly to institute the change, that is, to bring it about, in the sense of both economic, social, and psychological cost. The third thing which is important is the very technical feasibility of bringing about a change in the first place. That is, one must at some point assess whether or not the change is in the realm of already available technological and institutional capabilities, because if it's not, then the possibility of bringing it about is much less, obviously. So I'm going to talk with reference to these three indicators and attempt to make an assessment of what the status of women will be. Let's take the significant changes in reverse order, because they're easier to talk with and they really fit that way logically. Take the change in stereotyping, that is, the desire on the part of people today to eliminate stereotypes of men and women. There are currently, and it is very likely that there will continue to be in the next 15 years, groups of individuals who will indeed pressure mass media and educational media to eliminate its open and blatant use of stereotypes. So in a sense, there are groups who would pressure for this change. It is also at the same time very unlikely that there will arise groups who would oppose such a change, because it just doesn't make a very good argument in today's acceptable value system. So in a sense, it's very likely that the change will be perceived in the world as a beneficial one. The cost of making such a change, there are some costs in making it, namely the cost of finding and locating the offending source of the stereotype and initiating actions to stop them. There is also the cost of developing new stereotypes, for it is unlikely that one does not describe, it is unlikely one describes an entire class of people like women or men or anybody else except in stereotypes. That is, you don't describe classes except in characteristics ascribed to the classes. You describe individuals sometimes in terms of the stereotypes appropriate for a group. But it is clear that some stereotype will develop. It's just a question of what will replace the ones that are currently no longer in vogue. What about the feasibility of making the change? I think this is perhaps the most significant difficulty for changing stereotypes of men and women. And the reason is that stereotypes which are in vogue are the result of a rather large educational process which begins with the development of children. Stereotypes which are published in mass media are perhaps the easiest to correct, but at the same time, they are the rather insignificant aspect of the problem. The main transmitter of stereotypes are the socializing agents who develop children into the culture's mode of thinking about various things. That is, the parents of children at first and schools secondly. It is known, for instance, that children demonstrate sex-related preferences very early in life, around 3 years of age. In one study, for instance, children of various ages are given common objects found in the home, such as spoons, pots, pans, combs, shoes, and so on and so forth. And they're asked a very simple question about these common objects. They're asked, is this a mommy object or is this a daddy object? And it's found that by 4 years of age, children of both sexes are almost perfect in identifying the correct classification of the object in terms of how it's used in the dominant culture. That is, objects that tend to be used by women are identified as mommy objects. Objects which tend to be utilized by men are identified as daddy objects. Thus, for instance, a spoon is clearly to a child of four a mommy object, and a hammer is clearly a daddy object. Children are also more accurate in identifying female objects at this age than male objects. And the reason that's most likely is because of the frequency of contact with female objects rather than male objects, due to the fact that most of the time they spend as a small child is with their mother. Moreover, when the children are asked which of these objects they prefer, by the age of five, 75% of their preferences are for same-sex objects. By the age of eight, there is absolutely no preferences for opposite-sex objects. So clearly, children have developed very early in life a rather stable and firm stereotype system, and in a very trivial way, namely the naming of objects. The study, like many other, merely testifies the extent to which cultural stereotypes are accepted by children. But as we all know, the process neither stops there nor is it restricted to the identification of role-related objects. Behaviorally, children of age 3 to 5 are equally likely to be aggressive or non-aggressive, regardless of what sex they are. However, in adulthood, the frequency of aggression in men is much less than the frequency of aggression in women, and aggression itself is very much correlated with sex. So something has transpired from the time you were 3 to the time you are 20.
Did you mean that? Less?
Which?
More frequent in men?
No, did I say less? I meant more, I'm sorry. That's very... for some of us. In another domain, mastery over the environment is taught more early and more emphatically to little boys than to little girls. Mastery over the environment is a very important trait to develop in children because essentially evolves into achievement motives. The extent to which mastery is taught can be indicated by a parent's answer to the question, at what age do you allow your child to go out alone, such as to the store or to school? You could ask, at what age do you expect your child to be able to know the way around town or the neighborhood? Although the data is not perfect because of the difficulty of asking questions like this, given that you usually rely on memories of parents rather than what they really do, it's generally found that the age at which boys are expected to be able to have competence over their environment is much lower than the age at which girls are expected. And it's also known that later in life, boys demonstrate in general more need for more high achievement motive than do girls. In fact, in schools, although girls are relatively high achievers in the early grades of their career, by the time they finish high school, they are lower achievers than they were before and generally lower than boys. Indeed, there have been some limited observations which indicate that young women have a tendency to actually fear success. This is a word used by the woman psychologist who discovered this phenomenon, and to lower their performance in the presence of young men. For one, it depends on the social implications. However, this data is not all that clear. It's a relatively unreliable phenomena to observe. And one of the things it depends on are the social implications of being an achiever or a non-achiever. For instance, young women who come from homes in which there has been no history of people in that family going to college tend to be extraordinarily high achievers. Probably because it's a very unusual event for them in the first place from their family setting, and they probably get a lot of social reinforcement once they commit themselves to it. So it's not clear about whether this phenomenon of male-female achievement is stable. But I mention these comments about the socialization process only because the likelihood of changing stereotypes about women and men is made more difficult by the fact that the agents of transmission for them are diffused. That is, they're difficult to get at and to alter because they're everywhere. Almost everyone who has the responsibility or who in some way affects or relates to the development of children essentially supports the stereotype system. And the forecast one can make about stereotypes is that they'll most likely be obliterated from the mass media by 1985 and perhaps sooner, but they'll probably be supplanted in the mass media by images of women which are more compatible with future role expectations of them. The second theme that dominated the comments from the NOW group was the theme of interchanging home and child care with men. That is, there was a clear desire that the roles traditionally assigned to women, such as the care for a home and the care for a child, be assigned to men. One form this has taken, as you know, I'm sure, is actually a desire to reverse those roles. And there are have been some limited experiments in Sweden where that was attempted in order to observe what would happen as a consequence. However, it's very unlikely that in this country complete role reversal will come about in large scale in the next 20 to 30 and probably even 50 years. And the reason it's unlikely is because the Sweden experience really arose out of a need to develop a labor pool, namely that existed in women. And that need is not as clear or as apparent in the United States. It's also expected that marriage, although it's been talked about a lot lately as being perhaps not a feasible form of having a stable social relationship, it's likely to continue, and that still 90 to 95% of the population will marry at least once, which is what it is now. It's also likely that divorces will increase too, which means you'll have moving up and down from married state to not married state. What's more likely to happen rather than complete role reversal is the new sociological phenomena known as the two-income household. That is where you have two adults who both have careers. This type of household is likely to increase, and there's also likely to be an increase not only because of desire to have them and because of the education level of both men and women increasing, but because there's also likely to be new arrangements for either federal daycare, privately paid institutional daycare, privately paid individual daycare, or free individual daycare. free individual daycare, of course, comes if you happen to have grandparents, relatives, who, or friends who sit with your children or care for your children while you're working. Some of the developments which are both spurring and being spurred by this arrangement are the following, and this is a list of forecasts that have been made to possibly some of them to occur within the next two decades. Increased technological making of food, such that 25% of all meals will have 90% of their preparation executed before they come into the house. That is, they'll be pretty much made before you even buy it. Well, that, of course, will increase time tremendously. Another event is the decrease in the birth rate or the having of children for many families. Another event, increased education potential among small segment of women, the traditional professional class, increased development and availability of transportation systems, which will facilitate the amount of time it takes to get from work to home, which would, of course, again, expand the amount of time available for work and the amount of time available for caring for the home. These essential two functions that define the roles. Another thing likely to occur is much more flexible scheduling of jobs outside of a specific place of work or a specific time. That is, just much greater flexibility in when you work and where you work. For instance, working in the home as opposed to working in an office. There are many tasks, many jobs that are currently done that can be easily done at one's home or residence as well as at the place of business. Another event, potential cheaper available daycare. Federal daycare is expected by the late 1980s with a somewhat greater but not too greater than 50-50 chance. There's also likely to be increased longevity, which will provide career possibilities for women in later ages after major child rearing, coupled with the likelihood that children will leave home at an earlier age to take part in work education groups such as VISTA groups. That, of course, will again expand the amount of time women have available for taking jobs. The present alienation and potential difficult relations between younger families and their parents, namely elderly people, grandparents, is expected to decline significantly in the 1980s. One possible benefit from that is that you may find a return to multi-generational families, which, of course, vastly increases the labor pool for caring for children and homes. And it's also economically sound because it would also decrease the amount of public support given to the caring of elderly people. Some of the pressures for the change, and for many of these changes, will come from such groups as many women's liberation groups currently in vogue, and they're expected to increase in the next 10 years. Most of the impetus will come probably from professional women and highly educated women. It's not surprising that the most vocal people about jobs, about these kinds of things, have been women who are educated, who have a vested interest in obtaining jobs, and so on. Some of the potential pressure against some of these developments is that there may be a large number of women who currently derive a major portion of their satisfaction with living and sense of worth from taking care of the house and children. That is, they may see federal daycare as a threat to their own personal satisfaction. Another possible opposition group may be working people and older people who will recognize that increased large-scale federal expenditures in child care will lead to increased taxes and potential limitations of the available monies for Social Security benefits. Another possible pressure against it will probably come from extreme right and extreme left political factions who will tend to see the implications for federal dominance in the development of children. That is, it's almost as if the Orwellian dream were coming true. alternative pressures for it is that there'll be an increased need for women in service occupations because service occupations are likely to increase a significant amount in the future. In fact, they'll represent about 70% of all the jobs in the future. And in addition, labor unions will probably argue for and fight for more flexible working hours and more less time in work, which would be, of course, a benefit to women because it would open up new possibilities for jobs. Some of the potential costs of this development have to do mainly with the coordination of these various types of changes. That is, role changes of any sort are major dislocations of society. And the psychological cost of making them are likely to be very heavy in the short run. To men and to women. And the reason for that is that the whole social system supports opposite expectations of both men and women, and if you simply reverse roles, then you're really fighting against an entire system of belief and pressure, which could have severe psychological consequences for people. On the feasibility, some of the arrangements about which are involved in reversing roles, that is, in these two essential tasks, namely working outside the home and working inside the home, are essentially individual decisions. That is, there's a lot of individual discretion. That is, two individuals or a family can partially arrange itself in such a way to maximize fulfillment of individual expectations, and to essentially change their roles in their family unit. So there's a lot of control. That's what I said before, that this cohort group, which is now at the age of child-rearing, is a very important group in the future because it's that group and the kinds of individual decisions they make which will very much affect the dominant cultural theme of the next decade. If they, on individual bases, decide to opt for more equalization of role expectations between men and women. For instance, the sharing of household duties, which I'm sure, by the way, goes on quite a bit anyway and has for a long time in our history, then that theme will probably dominate the media in those ages and probably dominate the institutions of those ages. The overall prospects is that there'll be an increase in two-income households by 1980 and a lot of these individual arrangements of two-career families, either partial or complete. And partial meaning that people, either men or women, will take part-time jobs and part-time care for the home. And there's it's not likely to be any great role reversals. On the question of jobs, how much time do we have? Let me just briefly run through the jobs. Many of the prospects for jobs follow partially from the role constraints that either I used as armament against opening up jobs to women or actually inhibit either men or women from taking certain jobs. First of all, I want to say I'm not an economist, and therefore I'm not really adept in the forecasting of various economic changes in American society. And however, I do know, because I have looked all over and asked all over, that there has not yet been done a very thorough analysis of the realistic prospects for jobs for women in the future. I've asked the Labor Department, in fact, sent them proposals about doing such a study, and in each case, they neither showed interest or they directed me to all kinds of published stuff which was somewhat related but really not a very careful or thorough analysis. First, it's important also to recognize that the nature of the desire for jobs is essentially a political contest. That is, there's going to be a contest for resources, a contest between various groups in society, men and women, and a contest between different power factions. Essentially, if your desire is to become the President of the United States or the President of General Motors, and men now dominate those positions, then in essence you are asking men to give up their power to you, which means you will be in contest for that power with them. And that's a reality that one has to keep in mind. But I think the future of jobs for women depend on essentially four questions having to do with various aspects of the availability of jobs and pressures for and against them. One question is, will there be an increase or decrease in the total number of available positions of power? That is, will jobs of this nature become more scarce or less scarce? And are they scarce now? Alternatively, what about the number of people vying for these positions, that is, the number of women or the number of men who are in contest for these power positions? The second question is one of conflict between groups. And independent of the scarcity of jobs, to what extent will jobs be reassigned to accommodate a more equitable distribution of the sexes? That is, to what extent will women move into jobs which were once dominated by men, and men will move out and into jobs which were once dominated by women? Another way of saying that is, to what extent will there be increased competition for the same jobs between men and women? Another dimension or question has to do with discretion in the allocation of jobs. In addition to their scarcity and the relative conflict between men and women for jobs, there's the question of the extent to which institutions and organizations will have discretion in allocating jobs along the basis of a sex discrimination. The primary ingredient to this is the extent to which the federal government will intervene in the employment function. And there's two kinds of interventions the government can make. One is to become the main employer of the future, and the second is to intervene in the nationalization of various privately held industries or directly intervene through law to these industries. A fourth question is the extent to which it's very similar to federal intervention, except it's more the visibility of actions of various organizations in allocating jobs along sex lines. To what extent will their actions be visible to a larger public in which such behavior is no longer acceptable? And that has to do with questions of, to what extent will corporations, for instance, become in general more accountable to a public? And that takes visibility. It takes publishing of what it is that corporations are doing. You've probably heard there's interest now in developing social audits of corporations. That is, instead of evaluating the profitability of a corporation, you evaluate what contributions the corporation has made to the society that year. And you also evaluate what losses and costs it has put upon the society. To the extent things like that increase, then, of course, you have increased visibility over organizations and probably decrease in such things as blatant sex discrimination. Well, I'd like to read through very quickly through some of the things, the forecasts that are relevant to the availability of jobs and to these other things, because it'll fix what my overall comment is about the possibility for increased jobs. First of all, when you ask the direct question of actually, for instance, in many forecasts we've done, people in government and business and all over the place, that is, the people who now are in power, you ask them what their intentions are, and you learn pretty quickly what the likelihoods are. When we ask them to forecast whether 10% of women, of 10% of executive positions in the United States would be held by women by 1980, their estimate on the probability of that happening was like 5%. So there's not a lot of optimism on the part of those who are most likely to be making the decisions about such things that it will come about. What I want to look at is some of the other events that will go on simultaneous, which will probably put pressures to bring about more equitable distributions of jobs. One event is the increased divorce rate which is increasing and expected to continue increasing to significant proportion, and the simultaneous decrease in the alimony payments to women due to the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment. If that happens, that is, if alimony payments to divorced women reduces, then this will put a force on a large number of women to get into the job market. Such a force would have an effect on opening doors. Another event, businessmen grant significantly more time off from work for either for civic work for men and women, and also time off for pregnancy for women. This event, while possible, is not likely in a significant amount, but it will affect both the making of more jobs, more women available for jobs by removing the present constraint that often exists, which is if you have a baby, it removes you from the job, the employable list. And it would also probably make more jobs available because if significant numbers of men are allowed time off to take part in civic activities as part of their benefit package, this would, of course, be restricted mainly to professional and managerial levels, then that opens up the need for new people to take over those positions on a part-time basis. Another possibility is that there'll be a general decline in the number of hours worked during the week. It's expected to go by 1985 all the way to 32 hours a week. This would, of course, have more time available for the taking of jobs and, in a sense, more opportunities for women. But at the same time, this is not likely to affect professional classes too much. It's mainly going to be restricted to laboring classes. Professional classes don't work currently 39 hours a week, nor are they likely to work 32 hours a week in 10 years. Most professions work anywhere from 50 to 70 hours a week. Another possibility is corporations allowing a significant amount of its current workload to be done in the home. I mentioned before that many corporations are toying with the idea that many of its tasks can be done at home. For instance, you can do, if you have a computer in the home, and I've known corporations that have set up arrangements with their brilliant mathematicians, both males and females, to give them a computer, let them stay at home and do anything they want, and the sheer compulsion of their interest in playing with the computer will result in great things for the company, and it has. It's likely that there will be an extension of this in the future. In addition, and very similar, is the more flexible working schedules. That is, many tasks don't need to be scheduled in 8-hour days. What needs to be scheduled in 8-hour days are physical plant facilities. That is, the heating arrangements of a building and so on. To the extent those aren't involved in how you utilize labor, there should be an increase in flexibility. Also increasing will be the number of college-age people actually attending college, up to 50% by 1985, as compared to 36% in 1969. This would, of course, increase the number of people available for these jobs and hence probably increase the competition for them. There'll be an increase in the service industry, which is expected to produce and provide for most of the new jobs that will come about in the future as opposed to old jobs. Government daycare centers, while they're not all that likely or not perceived to be that likely, would increase the availability of time to women and hence increase their possibility for taking jobs if there were any. On the other hand, decreasing the number of power positions will be such developments as concentration of power, which will come about by increasing size of firms. For instance, it's expected that there'll be a huge number of what have come to be called super firms in the future, and these are giants. $5 billion in revenues a year, which is an unbelievable amount. Well, as you concentrate more and more an organization, you also reduce the number of power positions, and hence there are few positions into which anybody who wanted to move could move. Another possibility is increases in part-time employment. That is, many new jobs will come about, which, especially in the medical service industry and training areas and other consultative areas, which will essentially be part-time jobs and hence increase options for women. On the other hand, there's other things that are likely to change it. But in terms of availability of jobs, there's likely to be a minor expansion, which will be open to women in jobs that are traditionally classified as male. And one reason for that is the following. That is, the conflict that will exist for those jobs. And there's two sources for the conflict. One is, and perhaps the most significant, is that attempts by women to acquire these positions of power are going to be competing against attempts by other groups. And one of the major groups that this competition will come from are blacks. That is, there are statements about national priorities in recent years which seem to indicate a preference for caring for the needs of blacks over women. And as you know, the most unemployed group in this country is of those who are categorized as in the labor market are young male blacks. Well, that's a competition for women because they're going to be competing for the same thing, the same positions of power. Not only that, but they're also likely to be competing for attention about other woes such as discrepancies in income. And it's very likely that the discrepancies between black and white incomes will probably be satisfied before the discrepancies between male-female incomes. Another source of conflict, as I mentioned before, is that is direct competition from males themselves, and especially in things that have been called male jobs, such as trucking, mining, and so on. Labor unions are likely to set up membership practices, which essentially will have the effect of attempts to exclude women in order to exclude them from those jobs, because they really wouldn't want to give up their jobs to women. And there's already been some confrontations of that nature with regard to some labor unions. The more subtle tactics, however, are likely to be in how jobs are named. One can name a job so it will appeal to males or to females. Essentially, you name them in such a way that they're defined as a woman's job, which would have the simultaneous effect of attracting women into it and excluding men from it. One example, the use of the term secretary as opposed to clerk would inhibit men from taking such jobs. A secretary is just a more feminine-sounding word in terms of our common stereotypes in our culture. There's also some benefit to business in defining jobs in a certain way, and they're not likely to give up such a benefit. Regardless of the operational duties and responsibilities of a job, by naming them in a certain way, it provides a rationale for paying the job in one way or another. For instance, if you name a job a secretary, as opposed to naming it an administrative assistant, you have had the effect of probably reducing the cost of that job, which let's say that it has the exact same duties associated with it. You probably, by naming it secretary, have named a job which only costs $7,000 to $8,000. But if you name it administrative assistant, you probably have increased the cost of the job to $10,000 and $12,000. And, in fact, this is a strategy practiced by business today in excluding women from jobs and excluding men. So, in a sense, the pressures are reality pressures. That is, there's other people who want the jobs. There's people who want to get labor as cheaply as possible. And those things have an effect. They have effect on what the options are. Well, let me close and just sort of say that my general conclusion is that there's not likely to be any sweeping change in the status of women, but there are likely to be some loosening up, especially in some jobs. those types of jobs are likely to at first be labeled in ways that are compatible with traditional stereotypes of women. For instance, the need for parapsychotherapists is a way of attracting women into a certain kind of task. And let me entertain questions unless you have to run.
You had said that the increase in availability of part-time jobs would increase options for women. I hope that was a slip of the tongue, because it seems to me it might also increase options for men.
Yes.
Right?
But only if you assume... No, the reason I said it that way was because...